Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our hundreds of past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about our education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Well, the robots are coming, and if your knowledge of the humanoid simulacrums doesn't extend beyond Forbidden Planet or Danger Will Robinson, you are in for a real treat today, because we have with us a scientist who is working to develop robots capable of doing things never dreamt of on Lost in Space. Joining me today on Radio In Vivo is Dr. Ron Alterovitz. Ron is an assistant professor in computer science at UNC Chapel Hill, and he leads the Computational Robotics Research Group. Ron earned his BS with honors from Caltech in 2001, completed his PhD at the University of California, Berkeley in 2006, and conducted postdoctoral research at the UCSF Comprehensive Cancer Center and the Robotics and Artificial Intelligence Group at LAAS-CNRS, which is the National Center for Scientific Research in Toulouse, France. He has co-authored a book on motion planning in medicine and co-awarded a patent for a medical device, and has received several awards in his young career, including the very prestigious National Science Foundation Career Award. And we've had several guests on the show who have gotten the Career Award. It's really quite an achievement. Ron has been on the faculty here at UNC since 2009. Ron, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thanks for having me.
I should mention that Ron actually came and spoke at one of our Science Communicators of North Carolina and Sigma Xi pizza lunch events recently, and was very well received. But we're going to face a bit of a challenge, since we won't have the benefit of the dazzling visual aids you brought to the pizza lunch to illustrate your descriptions of your work, but we'll just have to do the best we can with painting word pictures. And of course, we'll have links to some visuals when we post the podcast, so anyone who's interested can get a look at some of your incredible toys. Ron, first I'd like to kind of put a face on the field that you specialize in. I think most people think of robotics as a mechanical or engineering discipline. So what exactly is computational robotics, and how does that differ from what we traditionally think of as robotics?
Well, when people look at a robot, what they see are its mechanical components. So they see the motors, the gears, the wheels, the joints, limbs, and so forth. But there's also the expectation that the robot actually perform a particular task in the environment. So for an example, an industrial robot can assemble a product on an assembly line. A NASA robot on Mars can navigate among rocks on a different planet. And to do these various tasks, the robot must compute how to actuate its motors, how to actually move in that environment to accomplish a task. So what my group focuses on are these algorithms. How do we make how do we create these algorithms that enable the robot to move in its environment to accomplish these tasks? And that requires computation.
I see. So you're not actually, your group isn't actually designing the robots or hardware itself, but
yes,
concentrating on the skills.
Yeah, so we focus on the software that enables the hardware to do tasks in the environment.
Okay. So you're really programming the robots to do, as I've seen you put it, useful things.
Yes. And there's several different approaches that we've looked at. So if you look back at some of the earlier robots from maybe the 1980s and more industrial settings, typically what people would do is that they would program the robot very directly. Mm-hmm. They would tell it move from this particular place to that particular place, and everything was just hard-coded very precisely, and it would do the exact same thing over and over again. So what we're looking at more is sort of motion planning. So given some environment and a particular goal that we specify, having the robot automatically compute what should be its motions to avoid obstacles and accomplish the task.
I see. Okay. This is, I understand that one other aspect of it is that you're really teaching the robots to have the ability to learn for themselves.
Yeah. So part of it is that if we want the robot to automatically perform a task, there are several different ways we can do it. And so one approach that one class of approaches is to do more geometric-based approaches where we look at what the goal is and we look at where the obstacles are and when we try to automatically compute. Another approach that can help out is learning. So we can imagine teaching the robot through demonstrations, for example, holding the robot's arm to do a particular task. And then from these demonstrations, the robot's supposed to learn what are the key aspects of the tasks so that it can generalize and then perform that task in a new environment.
I see. So that's what's so-called machine learning? Is that correct?
So it uses elements of machine learning to enable the robot to learn to perform a task.
Okay. Well, Ron, tell us a little bit, before we get into the nuts and bolts, as it were, of the robots themselves, tell us a little bit more about your lab, the Computational Robotics Research Group. How many people you have and kind of what's the bricks and mortar you've got going?
So the Computational Robotics Lab at UNC house several PhD students, four right now, as well as multiple undergraduate students that help out on various research projects in the lab. And our group focuses a lot on research in medical and assistive applications. So because we focus on these application areas, we also have collaborators at UNC Medical School, in particular, collaborator in who's a physician in surgery, as well as collaborators in occupational therapy and occupational sciences. Since our focus is really more on the software, we also collaborate with other groups, particularly including a mechanical engineering group at Vanderbilt University. The focus is more on the design, physical design of some of these robots.
I see. Okay. Well, Ron, one of the really fascinating aspects of your work is that it really seems to stretch the boundaries of what robots even are. They're, you know, when the layman thinks of the robot, you think of a simple mechanical representation of a human being, a humanoid form. Robots are really much more than that, aren't they?
Absolutely. So the humanoid notion oftentimes comes from what we see in movies and so forth. So that is one class of robots where we have humanoid robots that try to mimic people and have arms and legs and so forth, which are extremely complex types of robots. But there are also many robots that are far more specialized. They're designed for a specific task. For example, the ability to navigate in the environment, or in some cases, medical robots that would navigate inside the human body. And so most of our research has focused on these more specialized robots for medical and assistive applications.
I see. So robots really have entered our everyday society in a way a great deal over the last particularly probably decade, I would imagine.
Absolutely. So there are several different robots that have now become commercially successful, which is sort of a new development. Hadn't in the past, most robots were sold and primarily present in industrial settings. Mm-hmm. Now we're increasingly seeing them in homes and hospitals as well.
Okay. Well, as you've mentioned, Ron, your group works in two very specific areas of medical and assistive robotics. And I want to definitely drill down into both of those sectors. But the characteristic they share is that both types of robots require complex motion planning algorithms. Tell us a bit about the challenge that you face in your group involved in designing those algorithms.
Okay, so there are several key challenges that come up when we look at robots that can be used in medical and assistive applications. The main difference is that now these robots are directly interacting with people. And this is really a fundamental change from where robotics was 20, 30 years ago. If we look back at robotics from back then, typically these robots would be in industrial settings, in factories, doing things like manufacturing, or they'd be, for example, a Mars rover on a foreign planet. Typically, they would not be interacting with humans. They'd be fenced off. They'd be in a remote environment. There would be no contact with humans. Now we're looking at having the robot actually interact with people, and that introduces some fundamentally new challenges. People move in unpredictable ways. Everybody is different. If you're looking inside a person for doing a medical procedure, everybody's anatomy and physiology somewhat different. So there's a huge amount of uncertainty that we have to deal with. And this wasn't present in some of these other applications of the past. So dealing with a lot of this uncertainty is one of the key challenges that our research group faces. So motion planning for these robots and these highly uncertain and dynamic environments.
Well, that's fascinating. It's really that uncertainty of dealing with the human element that is the major challenge in what you're doing then.
Absolutely. It really changes the nature of the algorithms we have to create to enable these robots to do useful tasks.
Now, how heavy duty is the math, as it were, in this pursuit? I mean, how much do you have to take into account the environment and yet boil it all down to the mathematics?
So yeah, so that's a key challenge of the algorithm development. So a lot of computer science is based on fundamental math, and so we do a lot of geometric-based approaches where we have to take the environment and model it using geometric primitives, typically meshes of triangular elements that allow us to model the environment that the robot is in. Then for a lot of the motion planning, we have to deal with a lot of statistics-based approaches. Since we have to deal with the fact that there is uncertainty in the environment, we can try to model that a priori, but we still have to model it as uncertainty distributions. Mm-hmm. And so dealing with these uncertainty distributions is a key challenge in motion planning.
Sure. So that's some very sophisticated statistics, I'm sure.
So yes, we do use some statistics methods.
More power to you on that. Ron, you know, one of the questions I had for you is, don't we already have pretty sophisticated robotics in both of these areas that you're working in? And, you know, I think many people would be familiar with the Da Vinci surgical systems that are robotic surgery, all the way to the Roomba that can go around and vacuum your floors for you.
Yeah, so both of these were very pioneering products in robotics, and I think they really helped set the stage for what hopefully will be another new generation of robots. So if we look back to maybe the year 2000, there were almost no robots in hospitals, and nobody had a robot in their home.
Mm-hmm.
So now we fast forward to today. Over 8 million Roomba robots have been sold. So now there are plenty of homes that have these robots to assist them with vacuum cleaning. And what this really shows is that people definitely have an acceptance of having a robot in their home. They want it if it will do something useful for them. And so this fact that if the robot can help with activities of daily living, people will want it, I think really opens up a lot of new possibilities for research, because now we can start to look at new, better types of robots that can do a lot more. And there's really the parallel also in the medical side. We look at the intuitive surgical Da Vinci surgical system. For those of you who aren't familiar, it's a type of robot where the physician sits at a console and then teleoperates a robot that's operating inside the body. And this is based on traditional laparoscopic procedures. The idea here is that the physician creates three small holes inside the abdominal cavity, inserts narrow tubes, and then it can control the surgical instrument that moves through those holes. So in this type of procedure, typically before it was done just by the physician manually controlling the tools, now the physician can do it with robot assistance, which can improve your accuracy, precision, and makes it easier for the physician to use. Mm-hmm. And again, just like with the robots in the home, now these robots in the hospital have shown that physicians are interested in using these robots if they can make the procedure easier to perform and with better results. And there is demand on the patient side as well for having the robotic-assisted procedure. And so that opens up a lot of new doors in terms of creating new medical robots that are specialized for different classes of procedures, not just laparoscopic procedures for which the Da Vinci robot is specialized in.
I see. And I understand that one of the things kind of general characteristics of, or one of the projects you've got going at your lab, is developing medical robots that will be able to work autonomously without that physician sitting in the next room.
Yes, we're looking at adding some level of autonomy to robots. I don't think we'll ever replace the physician sitting in the room. But what we can do is we can provide some intelligence to these instruments and these robots to decrease the cognitive load on the physician, so that when the physician is performing the surgical task, they have the benefit of being able to focus on the higher level, the more complex aspects of the procedure, without needing to focus on some of these low-level motion control aspects, mm-hmm. that we can add some intelligence to the system and through our software to make these robots easier and more effective.
And how is that coming along? Because that sounds like it would be really a significant advance.
Yeah, so so it's a very challenging problem. We're dealing with the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty. As I mentioned before, whenever we're operating inside the body, every patient is different. It's the complete opposite of something like an industrial setting where cars coming down the assembly line, each one looks exactly the same, and everyone sort of ideally should be exactly the same so that there aren't any flaws or problems. In a medical scenario, every body is completely different, and so that raises a lot of challenges. So there's uncertainty, there's also deformations, and so there are a lot of challenges. But we're taking steps in that direction. In particular, we're focusing sort of not on general surgery, but on more specialized medical devices.
I see. Well, let's dive into the medical robots that your group is developing. What skills are you working to give medical robots that they don't already have?
So looking at sort of devices in general, one of the devices that we're interested in is a steerable needle. So this is a device, is one of the ones that you mentioned that we have a patent on.
Right.
And the idea behind the steerable needle is that it can follow a curved trajectory inside the body. You look at a traditional needle, as well as you look at most surgical instruments today, they are straight lines. You look at a laparoscopic instrument, it might have a tip at the end that's a gripper, a cauterizer, a wide variety of different instruments, but it's going to be straight. So you have to go from some point outside the body to the point that you want to reach inside the body via a straight line. Mm-hmm. Needles, the same thing. They're all straight.
Right.
And so with a steerable needle, now we introduce the capability of being able to maneuver along curved paths inside the body. And that introduces a lot of new opportunities.
And be able to steer around obstacles to the goal. You showed some. This is where it would be great if we had the visual aspect, because when you showed some of the animation and slides on this, it was quite interesting. And so the needles that you're working on actually have a beveled edge, which allow that curvilinear motion, right?
Yeah, so one of the earlier designs that we looked at was that it would be a needle that has two key properties. It has the bevel tip that you mentioned, and it also has made of a very flexible material. The prototypes that we've used have been made of nitinol.
Of what?
Nitinol.
And what is that?
So nickel titanium alloy that has the properties of being very flexible, and it's more flexible than a material like steel, which is typically what needles would be made out of.
Mm-hmm.
And so these two properties have the effect that the bevel tip is asymmetric, and so it causes the needle to start to bend when you push it up against soft tissue as you insert it. And because it's highly flexible, it will bend a lot. And this causes it to basically bend in the direction of the bevel. And this is a technique that's actually been used a lot by physicians, or even just with traditional stainless steel needles, where if they want to make the needle bend a little bit, they sort of insert it with the bevel pointing in that right direction. But by really combining the bevel tip with the very highly flexible material, we can really amplify that to a much greater degree to enable steerability.
Mm-hmm.
And the other aspect of this is that what we now also can do is we can rotate the needle at its base axially, at the base, outside the patient. And because these needles are torsionally stiff, meaning they don't sort of twist axially along their axis, when you rotate it axially at the base, the tip will also rotate by roughly the same angle. And that changes the direction that bevel tip is pointing in, and that allows you to now steer in a new direction. Because if the bevel is pointed in a new direction, it will now start to bend in that new direction when you insert it. And that's what really gives us a steering capability.
I see. That's just fascinating. And so those are the types of algorithms that you're developing to be able to have precise control over that process, I take it.
Yeah, and there are two main benefits that we have by having the steerability. One of them that you mentioned earlier is that if there's an anatomical obstacle in the way, we can now steer around it. because we can follow this curved trajectory, we can bend around it, and then we can bend back to reach a particular target that was previously blocked if we were only restricted to straight line paths. And another aspect is being able to control the device as we insert it to correct for things like uncertainty. So as we push these needles through soft tissue, there's always going to be some uncertainty, so the needle may deflect a little bit from the intended path. And now with a steerable needle, if we can detect that deflection using some form of sensing or medical imaging, mm-hmm. now we can essentially steer it back. So we can actually use course
corrections as it goes.
Exactly, exactly. Wow. And so we're looking now at algorithms that can really give us this automatic obstacle avoidance capability, as well as the ability to steer back onto the intended trajectory when there are perturbations due to uncertainty.
Cool. Well, tell us a little bit about some of the actual applications you've worked on with this system, because I know you showed some examples at our pizza lunch that were really interesting, particularly with the radioactive seed.
Yeah, so there's technology. Several applications, and one of them is brachytherapy. So brachytherapy is a technique where physicians implant small radioactive seeds inside a cancerous tumor, and these seeds have to be very accurately placed so that there's a high radioactive dose distribution right near where the tumor is and a low dose radioactive dose distribution to the surrounding healthy tissues.
Mm-hmm.
So these seeds have an inverse quadratic falloff. Basically, the closer the tissue is to the seed, the higher the dose. And so these seeds have to be really accurately placed to make sure that the dose delivered is correct and meets the physician's specifications.
And this is now accomplished through needle insertion?
So the current approach is that a physician will insert a needle to implant these radioactive seeds, then essentially push the seeds out of the needle and retract the needle, and then the seeds are there and give the radiation to the tissue with a half-life of a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the common types of cancers that's often treated with this type of treatment is prostate cancer. And so prostate brachytherapy is a common technique used by radiation oncologists.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So how is the steerability applying to this?
So there are several benefits. So one aspect is the issue of obstacle avoidance. So in certain patients, the anatomy can be structured in such a way that it's more difficult to reach the prostate via straight line paths, mm-hmm. Particularly to be how the hip bone is shaped. And so this, with a steerable needle, it eliminates those challenges because now we can steer around those anatomical obstacles. And the other aspect is being able to hone in on target and get very high accuracy in these seed placements, because now we introduce the capability to make corrections in the needle trajectory during the procedure.
Okay, yeah, that's very cool. And where does this stand in terms of its specifically this in terms of its development?
So there are many steps that we have to take before a device that we've created in a lab and created a prototype of makes it all the way into the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
So we start typically by creating a robotic prototype. We do it in our lab, and we evaluate it using tissue phantoms, which are sort of representative proxy tissues.
Sure.
And a lot of the tissue phantoms that we've used are based on ballistic gels. So these are gel-like materials that people would use, for example, if they're testing the trajectory of a bullet through human tissues, things like this. And we're using it to now evaluate how our needles pass through human tissues, and the more medical application of these tissue phantoms. So that's what we start with. The next step that we typically take is we evaluate with ex vivo tissues. And so our group, as well as other groups, have done experiments in ex vivo tissues that include tissues like liver, porcine liver, porcine muscular tissue, mm-hmm. Turkey breast, things like this. And this allows us to evaluate in a more realistic form.
I see. Those tissues are similar to human tissues, I assume.
Yes. So we're moving toward more and more realism.
Mm-hmm.
One of the next things that we'd like to perform is studies on actual human cadavers, which would be the next step. Okay. And that would be a stepping stone toward doing clinical trials.
I see.
And embedded in all that, there would have to be some level of commercialization to really have a broader impact.
Okay. So is this one of the collaborations with the medical school?
Yeah, so a lot of this work started when I was working at the University of California, Berkeley, doing my PhD and postdoc years. So we have collaborators in the University of California, San Francisco. I've also been collaborating and setting up group collaborations with groups here at UNC Chapel Hill in areas like interventional radiology, and a lot of different applications we care about, not just these radioactive seed applications that I talked about, but for example, biopsies. There are many targets inside the human body that the physician from other medical imaging might deem as potentially cancerous, and they want to do a form of biopsy to get a tissue sample out to be able to evaluate it, to determine whether there is cancerous tissue there. And so for those procedures, a steerable needle would be very helpful because there are certain anatomical sites that you can't get to with just a simple needle, for example, in the liver, maybe in the lung. And now you could use one of these devices to essentially steer around these anatomical obstacles and make the make the procedure much more safe without having to resort to more invasive means of doing the biopsy.
That's so neat. I think the I would think the physicians would be very excited about the possibility of this coming into their hands.
Yes, so there's definitely interest. There's also a long lead time because there's a lot of fundamental research that we have to do.
Sure.
And so sort of in this sort of basic research that we're doing now, we sort of have to sort of temper expectations. It'll take some time
right.
before we can really get into the clinic. But if we take these steps, then we really can achieve essentially create a new class of devices.
And I know that this is not something to be held to, but what kind of rough timetable would you put on it, given that everything proceeds as one would hope?
So it definitely takes multiple years. Yeah. From the research lab perspective, we're doing a lot of the basic research and creating these prototypes. But a lot of the trials, especially as we move toward cadaver and human trials, becomes increasingly expensive. So the National Institutes of Health has funded a lot of our basic science research on the medical applications, as well as the National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm. As we move more and more toward the clinical application, the center's more in the commercial sphere. And so that involves commercialization of some of these ideas and then sort of using investments and so forth to help fund a lot of these more expensive trials.
Sure.
And at that point, it can be used across a wide variety of patients at that point.
Okay. Well, of course, that next step in the funding, given the current budgetary atmosphere, who knows, right?
Unfortunately. Who knows? Although we're definitely making progress.
Great. Well, that's good to hear. Well, Ron, tell us a little bit about the other class of robots you're developing for medical applications. These so-called tentacle-like robots. What are those about?
So the steerable needles that I mentioned earlier have the property that they can follow steerable paths, but they're limited to doing that inside soft tissues. So inside something like the prostate, inside the liver, inside lung tissue, for example. Mm-hmm. But it really requires a soft tissue medium in order to move through it, because it requires this asymmetric tip to sort of create these asymmetric forces that causes the needle to bend. What if we'd like to do procedures that are outside of a soft tissue, but in an open air cavity, for example? So something more of like a surgery as opposed to what would traditionally be viewed as a needle insertion procedure through soft tissues.
Mm-hmm.
But we still would like to be able to follow these curved paths. And so that's where these tentacle-like robots come in. So this was a term created by one of our collaborators, Bob Webster, at Vanderbilt University. And the idea behind
Bob, that's a scary term.
Well, it really,
we like the idea of tentacle-like robots.
But I think it evokes a property that we want, which is that we have sort of attached at a base. And it behaves like a tentacle in the sense that we can control this curved shape.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what we're going after here. So one of the devices that we're working on developing algorithms and software for are these concentric tube robots. And the idea behind this device is that it is made of a set of nested tubes. And each of these tubes is, again, made of nitinol.
Mm-hmm.
And these tubes are pre-bent. So they have a straight portion and they have some curved portion, which in most cases until now has been a portion of constant curvature, like an arc.
Okay.
And these tubes are nested. And what we can do is we can extend and rotate each tube independently. And so what this means is that if we have, for example, three nested tubes, they're going to now telescope within one another. And we can furthermore rotate each one axially around its base, so that it rotates with respect to the other tube. And because these tubes are not straight, but rather have a pre-bend to them, they're going to elastically interact and allow us to achieve a curve in space. And so if we have something like three tubes, we have 6 degrees of freedom. Basically, we have six knobs that mm-hmm. we can rotate.
Okay.
We have the sort of how far we insert each tube and how far how much we rotate each tube around its axis. And by controlling then those six knobs, we can adjust our curve in space.
Which allows what?
Which allows the physician to then follow these curved trajectories inside the human body.
Okay.
So that sort of leads to sort of what are the applications that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. So where do we need to be able to follow curved trajectories like this inside the body. And a really exciting there's several applications we're looking at. One of the applications that I'm really excited about is for endonasal procedures. So the particular class of procedures is near the skull base. So the skull base is essentially where the neck meets the head, but in the center of your head. So sort of right in the dead center, behind your nose. And one of the structures that's there is the pituitary gland. And if a patient develops a cancer in the pituitary gland, this is a very hard area to access to resect the tumor, to remove it from the body. So neurosurgeons have a difficult task when they have to remove a tumor there. So there's several different pathways that you can take, and you can start to imagine how do you get to the center of the head,
right?
In order to remove a tumor. So one route is that you can actually.
And I would think that often that would be considered inoperable just for that very reason, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In a large number of cases, this is inoperable.
Okay.
When a physician does choose to go to that site, one thing that they can do is they can drill through the top of the skull and maneuver then through healthy brain tissue, which brings a whole host of risks that they want to avoid.
Yeah, of course.
An alternative option is you can actually remove the top part of the skull, essentially lift the whole brain and then reach underneath to access the pituitary gland.
Oh, I don't think so.
That is sometimes done. That is sometimes done, but as you point out, that also is clearly very invasive, as physicians would like to avoid that.
Yeah.
And so in other cases, what they will do is they will stick a device up somebody's nose through the nasal cavity, and then there's a few small bones you can drill through near the sinus cavities, and then you're really right at the pituitary gland. Now, the challenge is that with existing instruments that are straight, you have to use a straight line path through the nose, through these sinus cavities to get to the pituitary gland. And by the time you finally get to the pituitary gland, you essentially are sort of locked into the straight line path and you have almost no maneuverability.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning once you're there, you can do a little bit of suction to remove part of the tumor, but you really don't have the ability to sort of reach around and get a lot of the deeper nested cancerous tissue. And so that's a big limitation of current techniques. So with a device like this, what we can do with a new device, like a tentacle-like robot made of concentric tubes, we can now maneuver through the nose, through the nasal cavity, get to the pituitary gland, and now we have the option of being able to follow this tentacle-like path, these curves in space, as we can really then enable the physician to clean out the entire tumor as opposed to just what was directly accessible by the straight line path.
Mm-hmm.
And that really opens up a lot of new possibilities there for physicians.
Yeah, that sounds like a major advance in that area.
Yeah.
One thing about cancerous tumors, if you don't get it all, they tend to grow back.
Yeah, and so it is important in terms of long-term survival to get absolutely as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of this is safety. Basically, typically tumors are going to be inoperable if the procedure for attempting to remove that tumor is going to be more dangerous or too risky compared to the possible benefits. And so physicians will choose just simply not to operate.
Right.
And one of the key complications that physicians face in deciding whether the tumor is operable or not is if you're doing a procedure in the skull base, especially near the pituitary gland, they have to be mindful that the carotid arteries pass right nearby those structures.
Oh, great.
And these are critical vessels. If you puncture or damage these blood vessels, the patient will most likely die on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So you really have to avoid touching them at all costs. And so with a straight line instrument, you simply can't reach around them to get tumors that are sort of around them, because then you risk damaging these structures, damaging these critical vessels.
Yeah.
But if we had a device that could follow these curved trajectories inside that cavity around the pituitary gland, you'd actually bend around these vessels, avoiding touching them, and still be able to get some of the tumor that's possibly located behind them. And so that can hopefully increase the class of tumors that physicians will then be able to consider as operable, and hopefully cure more patients.
Absolutely. I would think that this would, the next step beyond the pituitary would be brain surgery itself.
Yeah, so that is, so we are talking with physicians in neurosurgery here, as well as at Vanderbilt, looking at different applications there as well. So there are a whole host of different neurosurgical procedures we could look into. one of the benefits we had of the pituitary gland is that a lot of the traveling distance is through the nasal cavity. It's a little bit easier to model. And so just from a computational and testing point of view, it's easier for us to start there.
Sure.
But I think once we look at that, get that initial prototype of the robot working and evaluated in skull phantoms and then in cadaver skulls, and then we can start to move toward looking at other applications as well once we've nailed that down.
So is this in any different stage of development than the steerable needles in terms of where you are in approaching the clinic?
So we're in a similar stage in that we've done experiments with skull-based models. A lot of our work initially has been in simulations based on these anatomy-based models. There's also our collaborating group at Vanderbilt has also done, that's part of the mechanical design, working with physical skull models. And we've done a lot of planning algorithms for this on our end. So, for example, can we enable the physician to control where the tip should be to perform the surgical task and have our software automatically compute what should be the extensions and axial rotations of each of these tubes in order to achieve the right curve and space to reach that target and avoid all the anatomical obstacles on the way. And so that's really a critical component, I think, of making a device like this work, because if we were to tell a physician, here's this really cool device that can now follow these curved paths inside the brain and inside the head and tell them, well, to make it follow these curved paths, you have these six knobs here to adjust and go figure it out.
Good luck.
It's going to be very hard to focus both on the clinical task at hand, which is already very complicated, and then also be adjusting these six knobs. That'll be really challenging. And so what we've looked at is we can make these devices easier to use so that the physician can focus on the clinical task, essentially, where should this tip go to actually do the clinical task and have the shaft shape automatically avoid obstacles and reach that target automatically using our motion planning algorithms. And of course, those algorithms have to deal with all the challenges we talked earlier, that they have to deal with uncertainty, they have to deal with anatomical variations and so forth.
And that's where the high-level math and statistics
that's where that comes in.
Algorithm design comes in.
Yes, that's where it comes in.
Well, that must keep you and your group pretty darn busy.
Yes, and definitely my students have been making excellent progress on these. There's some challenges. So,
cool. Well, so this is really all about the field that I think it's safe to say that you and your group are pioneering, which is motion planning under uncertain conditions. Is that accurate?
So we're definitely working in that direction. There are other groups as well, so I can't take credit for the entire field. But I think collaboratively, the field as a whole, we've been making a lot of progress in recent years. We go back, like I said, to sort of the 1980s, 1990s, where a lot of robots were operating in industrial settings. We didn't have this uncertainty to deal with. And so a lot of those algorithms that were developed back then don't apply well and extend well to these current problems where we have a lot of uncertainty. So we really had to explore that problem really in depth to create and extend those create new algorithms as well as extend some of the older algorithms to really deal with this uncertainty.
Now, might some of these new algorithms sort of apply back to the industrial setting and to some uncertainties that might be faced in those settings and be able to accomplish things that hadn't been able to accomplish before?
Yeah, so there are definitely opportunities there to look at applying our algorithms back to those industrial settings, and I think it won't apply so much to the robot that works under high repeatability in these sort of mass production settings,
like automobile.
Yeah, probably not so much there, but just some newer generation of robots that maybe are looking at lower volume production, where it might be a lower cost robot that has a little bit more of uncertainty in its ability to move in the environment. Those types of settings might be more amenable, I think. Our algorithms would be more useful in those types of settings.
Okay, well, but it's really the medical robots working to help improve healthcare delivery ultimately is the bottom line. What impact ultimately, Ron, do you see the types of robots you're developing, and I'm sure there are others, other groups are working on, what type of impact do you ultimately see in the clinic? Do you think this development will really have an impact on improving our healthcare?
So that is definitely our goal. I mean, that is what we're striving for. We want to improve patient care by creating a new device that can help treat more patients that were previously inoperable could now get treatment. Patients that previously could be operated on now can be operated with a device that enables greater safety. So that absolutely is our goal. There are many steps we have to take to go there that we talked about. But basically, if we don't do this fundamental research now, then these devices definitely will not enter the clinic. But if we do this basic research now, and then we run the experiments, we go toward those cadaver studies, we go toward the human trials, we go towards FDA approval of these devices, then there's a potential for this to really have an impact, and that's what we're aiming for.
And that's kind of what gets you out of bed in the morning, I imagine.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that is, you know, I hear that so often from people who are working in, even peripherally, as you are, in healthcare and medical research. So that's cool stuff.
Thanks.
My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Ron Altarovitz. He is head of the Computational Robotics Lab at UNC Chapel Hill. Well, Ron, let's continue with our discussion about the work that your lab is conducting. Tell us a little bit about the little humanoid robot you're developing to assist people in their homes.
So we're definitely interested not only in our medical applications, but also to assist people in their homes. And the main connection in our research group is that both of these problems require motion planning under uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to operate inside a patient, clearly there's a lot of uncertainty there. If you want to assist someone in their home, there's a lot of uncertainty there. And so we have several robots that we've been using. One of the ones is the one that you mentioned. We have a child-sized humanoid robot. And our main focus is on developing algorithms for it, being able to teach this robot how to do tasks in order to help people with activities of daily living.
So what types of tasks and skills are you working on? What are the objectives?
So our main focus is to help people with disabilities and older adults.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a project that's being funded by the National Science Foundation. And we're working with Jennifer Womack, who's in the Department of Occupational Therapy and Occupational Sciences at UNC Chapel Hill. And she points out that a lot of people, as they get older or due to injury or disability, may lose range of motion on certain limbs, particularly including upper arms. And this can have a big impact on the types of activities that they can do. So you can imagine that if you lose the ability to move your arm above shoulder height, that means that you're going to have trouble feeding yourself. You're going to have trouble brushing your teeth, combing your hair, just basic things that we sort of take for granted. Now, if you can't lift your arm above your shoulder, you can't do these sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so what often happens when people start to lose range of motion in the arm or other limbs is that they start losing independence. They may have to be moved from their home to a nursing home or other form of assisted living.
Sure.
And that becomes expensive. It becomes traumatic. It becomes undesirable. And so our goal is, and our long-term goal here, is if we can develop robots that could now help people with some of these activities of daily living, then some of these older adults and people with disabilities could maintain their independence for a longer period of time, stay in their home for a longer period of time, which may be what they desire.
Sure.
And therefore provide sort of a big positive impact on their lives. And so there are a lot of challenges that we have to address from a robotics perspective to create a robot that can assist people with these activities of daily living. But this is the basic research. We're doing it now with the hope that in the future some of these ideas can enter people's homes.
That's wonderful. I mean, you can imagine this is probably several decades out, I would think.
Yes.
In terms of actually being in someone's home, because there's a lot of work to do there.
Absolutely.
The video you showed at the pizza lunch was training the robot to hold a cup of sugar, was that correct?
So a lot of tasks that we'd like the robot in an assistive setting to be able to do is to transfer things,
mm-hmm.
Particularly, for example, food. If somebody can't lift their arm above their shoulder, they may have trouble eating, and so they might need someone to help them bring a utensil to their mouth. Also, different aspects of food preparation. You may have to move something from one container to another.
Now, let me make sure we're not talking about teaching people robots to flip burgers because it'll put so many people with fast food out of work.
So there are other applications there, but we're really focused more on people with disabilities, and we'll see where else the technology
okay,
takes us.
Okay, very good.
So the example that you pointed out was we had it was a sugar transfer task, and mm-hmm. so the robot had to scoop some sugar out of one container and then carry it over with a spoon and dump it in another container. In that case, it was a cup
mm-hmm.
To prepare some coffee or some tea. So in a scenario like that, it looks like a very simple task. You can think of, well, just scoop the sugar and transfer it to the cup, and it looks very
simple.
Until
you try to start teaching a robot how to do it.
Exactly. Right? And then you start to realize all the nuances that people actually take for granted. Mm-hmm. So just a couple that people take for granted. We know that scooping motion to get the sugar onto the spoon, and we just sort of know how to do that. Another one that we take for granted is that as we carry the sugar with the spoon to the cup, we keep the spoon level and not tilted so that the sugar doesn't spill out. And then only when we reach the cup do we tilt it so that the sugar explicitly does fall out. And so there's sort of a sequence of constraints on the orientation and position of the spoon that the robot there has to do, mm-hmm. has to maintain in order for the task to succeed. And so one of the approaches that we've taken for this task is a learning from demonstrations approach. And so the idea behind that is that we place the robot in a scene where there is a sugar bowl, where there is a jar of sugar, there is a cup, and we just hold the robot's hand, and we guide it through the motion a few times to show it how to do this task. So during those demonstrations, it can record information, it can record where the different objects are in the scene, it can record what its joint angles were in doing the task and so forth. And then based on that information, we apply our statistics-based algorithms, and we learn what are the important parts of the task. And our goal is to then automatically learn mm-hmm. what is important. It should automatically learn what should be the sequence of motions to make that scooping motion. Mm-hmm. It should automatically learn that it needs to keep the spoon level, and then automatically learn that when it gets right over the cup, then it can start to tilt and release the sugar into the cup. And so that's really what's been our approach. If we can automatically learn all that, then we can put this robot in a new scenario where objects are in different places, everybody's kitchen's a little bit different, and it can still then perform that task because it learned the essence of it.
Okay, so that is artificial intelligence part of the picture here?
Yeah, so that's one term to use. We can also look at it as applying machine learning-based approaches. Mm-hmm. Really, we're putting together a bunch of different techniques. We're using some machine learning. We're also combining it with motion planning because now the robot has to not just learn what these key aspects of the tasks are. It also has to maneuver through an environment that possibly has obstacles and still accomplish the task. So if there are other objects on the table, it needs to make sure that it avoids them and doesn't, for example, tip the wine bottle over mm-hmm. as it's doing mm-hmm. the task. So it needs to handle that obstacle avoidance, and every kitchen is different, every table is different, every home is different. It has to adapt to all those scenarios. So it really has to generalize. So really combine a bunch of different tools in terms of learning as well as motion planning.
I see. What other types of tasks are you looking to develop with the robot?
So we're starting with some of these transfer tasks, which I think is a good place to start because it's a simple scenario that lets us look at a lot of these constraints and being able to learn them automatically. Mm-hmm. But in the long term, we like to go toward tasks that have more direct human interaction. So this would require directly helping a person eat, directly helping a person, for example, comb their hair. Some of these other tasks, this is still a couple of years out to be able to look at some of these tasks where we have direct interaction with humans.
Sure.
But it's definitely the direction that we'd like to take, and that's what we're working on toward the future.
So I unceremoniously characterize this as being several decades out, and that's probably not accurate and not fair, but what would your estimation be of something like this being, say, commercially available?
So it's always really hard to make a good estimate
about these
sorts of timelines. Because it's really hard to know, I guess, what's easy and what's hard. Mm-hmm. Some things that we view as hard, you just have a spark of an idea and all of a sudden it becomes solved. Other things that we think are easy, we come up into significant challenges. So it's hard to know. The timelines that I give in sort of a few years of starting to look at these problems are much more in a research lab setting. Mm-hmm. But if we look sort of 10, 20, 30 years down the road, I think it's definitely going to have an impact in people's homes. It's very hard at this point to know what these robots will look like,
sure.
How humanoid they will be, what their shape will be,
and
how
a lot
big
of
and bulky.
Anthropomorphic identification with these
Absolutely.
Creatures, isn't there?
So and also, what will humans want in their home? Do they want it to look too much like a human? Maybe not. A little bit more of an industrial design.
I'll give you the key right now, Ron. A robot that can go get me a beer and open it and bring it.
Yes, and there has been progress on that, I do have to say.
Oh, thank goodness.
But there are still years in order to make that reliable and low-cost enough that you can actually do that in your home. So there's definitely research challenges here to solve. But hopefully we'll get there.
No need for children anymore.
And no need to help. But as I said, sort of our key focus, at least initially, is to help people with disabilities, older adults.
Sure.
But once that technology is achieved, if we can help other people as well and produce a broader audience, that can help lower the cost of these robots and make it more accessible to everybody, which would be great.
Wonderful. Well, I understand that you let me know that you've just added a new robot to your lab, a machine called Baxter, which is made by Rethink Robotics from Boston. Tell us about Baxter and what your group is planning to do with him.
So yes, so we recently got the Baxter robot. It's made by Rethink Robotics, which is a company that was founded by Rodney Brooks. So he's had an illustrious career in robotics. He originally founded iRobot, which created these iRobot Roomba robots that a lot of people now have in their homes.
Oh, okay.
He sold over 8 million robots that already are in people's homes.
Yeah.
Now he's looking at a new domain and looking at essentially a small-scale manufacturing, which we talked about briefly a while back.
Mm-hmm.
So in small-scale manufacturing, we can imagine something like a small business. They're not going to be mass-producing millions of something or tens of thousands. And so they're not going to invest a large amount of money up front in buying these expensive, very precise robots and then programming them to do the same thing over and over again on an assembly line because their volumes are too low.
Sure.
And so typically for these low volume production tasks, a lot of this is still being done by hand. Somebody hand assembles these smaller products, typically overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And that also raises a whole set of intellectual property issues because now somebody overseas has their intellectual property and their problems with leaks and so forth. So if we could do a lot of this small-scale manufacturing here in America, we wouldn't have some of these leak problems that we do in overseas. But there's some challenges with that. Basically, there's high cost of labor and so forth. Can robotics help in terms of small business, small-scale manufacturing on low volumes? And the Baxter is, that's what their initial target audience is. So the Baxter robot is, it's like the upper body of a human. So it has two arms, each with 7 degrees of freedom. So it basically can maneuver like a human arm, where it can grasp something, can also move around its elbow and avoid obstacles along the way, even in a cluttered environment. And it also is very low cost. You can get roughly a decently configured system for around $25,000, mm-hmm. which is much lower than industrial robots that typically run in the hundreds of thousands.
Sure.
For just oftentimes only one arm, and this comes with two. And what you do is you sort of wheel it up to your workstation, and then you essentially need to program it to do some various tasks. Now, what we're looking at in our group is taking some of the algorithms that we developed for home assistants and applying it to this robot. It can be applied then to manufacturing settings and small-scale manufacturing environments. We can also use it as a test platform for our assistive algorithms that could interact with the person as well. So one of the key extra features that this robot has that I think makes it very promising for home assistants as well as environments with humans is that unlike a traditional industrial robot arm, this one has a series of elastic actuators in its joints. And what the big impact of that is that rather than when a joint moves and the robot moves, instead of the person just having to really get out of the way because the robot's... If somebody gets injured, it's not the robot.
Right.
That's the way an industrial robot is set up.
Mm-hmm.
With a robot with these series elastic actuators, it's very compliant, meaning that if it bumps into a person, it will sort of stop exerting force progressively.
Okay.
It will have sort of a softer contact.
It will not be running amok.
It will not be running amok. And so therefore, it's not going to be dangerous for the human to work and operate next to the robot. And that's a critical requirement as well for home assistants. The robot has to be safe to operate against people. Mm-hmm. If the person accidentally swings their arm into the robot's path, we hope that the robot's arm will be compliant, it will move out of the way, and it won't hurt the person in the process. And that's a very important feature. And this robot has that property, which is very important.
That's great. So it's going to really allow you to kind of leapfrog your progress in that field then.
Absolutely. And it's also I think it will help the field a lot because of these lower cost robots will enable us to really advance the rate at which we move, because our research will then require essentially less funding to be able to do more quality and higher quality research. And this is a very exciting robot for our group to have and really sort of start to allow us to develop our methods and apply them on adult scale scenarios with real people.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, Ron, it's just fascinating to hear you talk about all this, and obviously it's something that is a lifelong passion for you. Tell us just a little bit more about your own background and how you happened to get into this field. Were you one of those science fair robotic kids?
To some extent. I mean, I did enjoy computer programming when I was younger, mm-hmm. But I definitely didn't enter robotics until a little bit later.
Okay.
If you would have asked me the same question in high school, what do I want to be? I was debating at that point between entering history, architecture, and computer science. I ended up picking computer science, which I'm very happy with. I enjoyed the fundamentals of the field. And then I entered robotics actually not until I was in graduate school, in part because I liked the fundamental algorithms and mathematical background of computer science and developing these algorithms and then applying it to these robots that really operate in the real physical world and can have a large impact on medicine. And that's where I got started, and I've been very happy and working in this field. It's very fascinating.
Absolutely. Well, there it's such a wide panorama of projects available to you. It must be, you know, and really, not to belabor it, but really cool stuff.
Yeah, and I think it's a really fun time to be in robotics right now. I know a lot of young people now getting excited working in things like FIRST competitions in middle school and high school and so forth. Robotics has really just entered this place where there's a lot of hardware and technology out there right now mm-hmm. that can really be a lot of fun to do and to work with, and now it really opens up a lot of possibilities for robotics in the future to really touch people's daily lives and to a much greater extent than it did 20 years ago.
So where more specifically do you think the field is headed? What will we see, in 20 years that we can only dream of today?
So there are a lot of directions this can head in. And Bill Gates recently said in an article in Scientific American that the robot industry is akin to the PC industry 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. We will soon have a personal robot in every home. And the timeline, we don't know exactly when that will be, but I agree with the sentiment wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm.
And I often tell this to my students when they're joining my group. You can either go and buy your robot off Amazon.com in 30 years, or you can help design and build them right now.
Right.
And that's what we're doing. We're trying to look at what can we do 10, 20 years, 30 years down the road, and do the fundamental basic research to enable robots to reach that potential.
Terrific. Well, Ron, it's been a wonderful hour. And it's been great fun learning about the amazing world of robotics on Radio In Vivo today. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks again for having me.
Absolutely. We've got some great guests lined up here on Radio In Vivo in the coming weeks. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows. And we are on Facebook, so we invite you to become a fan and stay up to date. Join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. And you can log on to the WCOM website, WCOMFM.org, and click on the Donate Now button to make a contribution. And now be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Catch you next time. Thanks for listening.